Time now for the international edition of our occasional Climate Change Reporters Roundtable. We hear from journalists around the country and today around the world covering the beat and the challenges they face, as, of course, world leaders are meeting in Scotland for the climate summit COP26. First, Marina Eisen from Buenos Aires, Argentina, a freelance environmental journalist and co-founder of Periodistas por el Planeta, or Journalists for the Planet. She joins us by Skype. Marina, hi.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Mm-hmm. Tanisha Phillips is in Johannesburg, South Africa, an economic justice reporting fellow with The Mail and Guardian, an investigative weekly newspaper. She reports on the intersection between economics and climate change. Tanisha, welcome to you.
Hi, Robin. Thanks for having me.
And Josette Enano in Manila in the Philippines, an independent journalist, previously the environment reporter for the daily English newspaper, the Philippine Daily Inquirer. Josette, thank you for being here.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, all different time zones. So we really appreciate it. And we should say your home countries have delegations at COP26, but because of COVID concerns, you're all covering it remotely. But you are following these issues. Marina in Argentina, let's start with you. You're interested in stories about fracking and deforestation. Lots of news about both. I mean, talking about cutting back on cutting down trees. Talk about your concerns.
Yes, we have been destroying the great Chaco forest of northern Argentina since the 2000s with GMO crops, especially soybeans, and also with cattle ranching. So we are sending lots of emissions to the atmosphere.
And what do you think of the pledge that more than 100 world leaders signed on to at COP26 to end deforestation by 2030?
Well, it's bittersweet for Argentina. Argentina didn't want to sign the pledge, and it was forced to by the diplomatic pressure and also civil society, and it could have been a scandal.
Well, and other deforestation plans have failed, so we'll keep an eye on that. But meantime, President Biden announced that more than 90 countries have signed on to his global pledge to cut methane emissions by 30% by 2030. Scientists suspect there's a connection between more methane and fracking. So thoughts on that?
Yes, this is a pledge that it's not very clear what is the real scope of it, how you're going to implement it. Argentina, at the same time that it's signing this pledge, is promoting more fracking in Patagonia. And we know that methane emissions are especially related to fracking. So it doesn't make much sense. It sounds like another empty promise to me.
Yeah. Let's turn to Tanisha Phillips there in South Africa, reporting a lot on funding for climate adaptation and mitigation. Your country has severe drought. And you also are writing about a just energy transition from coal. There was some news on the coal front at COP26 on Tuesday. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson announced a partnership with the U.S., the U.K., the EU, and Germany to help South Africa transition out of coal. Let's listen.
We're working with President Ramaphosa, Cyril Ramaphosa, to deliver his ambitious vision for faster, greener growth, helping to lead an $8.5 billion partnership to decarbonize what is currently the most carbon-intensive energy system in the world, and by choking off international finance for coal.
Tanisha, there in South Africa, we, of course, have concerns about coal here. We have, you know, huge climate change plans being held up by one state concerned that they're going to be forced out of coal too fast. But give us context for, you know, how big is coal in South Africa? What is the talk?
Well, we are the 12th highest emitter in the world and the highest emitter on the African continent. So two utilities, that is like Sasol, which is a petrochemical giant, and the state power utility Eskom, which really takes up the bulk of our greenhouse gas emissions. And so this announcement, I would imagine, is very welcomed by the South African government because the state power utility Eskom is in a very precarious financial situation. They actually cannot afford to transition. We just have about just under 80% of South Africa's power is coal-fired, and we have about 6 coal-fired power stations reaching their end of life. And so they will be decommissioned in the next few years by, I think, about 2030. It will be about 6. and then that number will increase by 2035.
I'm wondering, what's the mindset there? People for generations have worked in coal. Do people want to move away from coal? Or is there a sense that they're not accepting climate change or they don't want to make the transition?
I think it's a little bit of both. You know, the political atmosphere has sort of been racked by tensions, and it's because the coal industry and the value chain sort of employs so many people. And with South Africa being in the midst of an employment crisis and worsened, obviously, by the COVID-19 pandemic, it does make it a very, very difficult process. The sort of climate discussion is evolving. There are plans to sort of repurpose coal-fired power stations to become hubs for manufacturing off-grid containers, manufacturing green hydrogen, which South Africa is really looking to capitalize in and position itself as, you know, one of the biggest export markets for green hydrogen in the future. So I think that the climate change discussions and sort of narrative in South Africa is really improving, particularly because the presidency, you know, established this presidential climate commission, and they've been hosting dialogues and hearings and having really difficult conversations with various stakeholders like the labor unions, who have, you know, largely been opposed to an accelerated phase out of coal. Yeah. And this finance, I think one of the conditions is that we're not only planning to phase out coal, we are accelerating the phase out of coal.
And you mentioned the finance, and that's the $8.5 billion partnership announced by Britain's Prime Minister Johnson. And that will help. I'm going to go to Gisette in the Philippines. We know huge issues. We see them: monsoons, typhoons, the extreme weather, sea level rise. But you've been focusing on the psychological impacts of climate change. Tell us about that.
Well, the Philippines is a very interesting spot to look at the climate change or climate crisis, as we call it, because while it contributes very little to the global emissions, it is essentially climate crisis is a year-round story for the country. As you said, we are hit by numerous typhoons, at least an average of 20 typhoons every year. In 2019, I went back to the center of where Super Typhoon Haiyan hit in 2013 and found that many communities have really found it hard to bounce back from the effects of the super typhoon, not only in terms of, you know, economic, you know, recovery, but also recovering from what they have experienced, even if it has been already a few years. And in my reporting, I also come across many young people who are climate activists who have reported feeling climate anxiety and climate grief over this fight that they are taking on as young people, being at the forefront of the climate movement, that the world essentially for them is not just burning, but also being flooded.
Well, and we wonder, I mean, the Philippines is a huge, expansive island nation. But is there resentment against the super polluters and the wealthier countries in the world that they have in some way screwed this up, you know? And those feeling it the most are people at sea level.
That's right. Well, climate activists in the Philippines and even the government has been very adamant in demanding climate justice. And I think this is something that the Philippines has long fought for ever since in the past few COPs, starting with the Paris Agreement, when we have played a very important role in pushing for 1.5. And that it is important that super polluters and rich nations should step up and take responsibility and be accountable for what they are doing, because it's really us who are, you know, not really emitting. Our emissions are less than 1% of the global emissions, but we are really suffering from the worst impacts that is even yet to come in the next few years.
Yeah. Marina Eisen, I want to go back to you in Argentina just to ask, you are co-founder of Periodistas por el Planeta, journalists for the planet. And you help reporters translate the urgency of climate change. How do you do that? You know, how do you get that urgency across? It's been decades.
Yes, I know. And it's been frustrating because we have been in the newsrooms before and we decided to leave our newspapers in order to form this NGO to start working in messaging for journalists and for the public in general to spread the message of the urgency. And we are taking small steps, but we are making inroads as well. And people are beginning to understand the importance of this topic, how it is related to economic and political decisions, societal decisions, how it's related to gender issues. So talking to people individually and collectively, we are slowly but surely making inroads. It's a lot of work.
Well, we thank you all for your work. Marina Eisen in Buenos Aires, Argentina. Tanisha Phillips in Johannesburg, South Africa. Jacette Enano in Manila in the Philippines. All on the climate change beat, which, you know, 30 years ago was a much smaller beat. So thank you so much, all of you.
Thank you so much, Robin. From Buenos Aires.
Thank you for having us.